Welcome to this edition of the Iowa Blog. I'm your host, Craig Wynn. With all of the upheaval in the world and the demonic displays of celebrating death being orchestrated in Gaza, as well as Muslims and progressives marching in the streets throughout Europe and on college campuses around the United States, it is incumbent upon me as the foremost expert on the religion of Islam in the world today. No one knows this religion, Muhammad, Allah, the Quran, and Hadith, and its inceptions better than I do. I've written 5 volumes, 4,200 pages, to expose the inception of this religion, Muhammad's repulsive conduct, Allah's disgusting words, all so that there is a counter to all of the misconceptions and lies being conveyed throughout the world. So this series exists so that you might know the truth about Islam. Islam is not a religion in the sense of any other religion in the world. It was conceived as a criminal enterprise, as I will prove in this particular series. This is the criminal enterprise of Muhammad, as revealed through the 8th Surah, as it chronicles what occurred at Badr. And in this presentation, and this is part one of that series, you will see Muhammad as he really was. He was not a prophet. In fact, he never got a single prophecy correct. Allah was not a god. The Quran is not a religious text. It all exists. Muhammad's entire life was based upon coveting what belonged to others, stealing what belonged to others, murdering them and enslaving them to satiate his carnal desires. This is the truth about Islam. It is the reason that you find Muslims celebrating death today in Gaza. It is why you find Muslims marching in the streets saying that they have every right to kill, to rape, to plunder non-Muslims. This religion began in hell, and it has never left it. So I'm going to wield Muhammad's and Allah's words against them as we examine the very birth of Islam, how it was conceived, and how it emerged to plague the world. So as we begin, this is, if you want to follow along, this is the third of 5 volumes of Goddamn Religion. So that you know, Goddamn Religion has 4,200 pages of analysis, is based entirely on the Islamic Quran, of which the entirety is presented, and the Hadith, comprising the 4 oldest and most revered Hadith sources in Islam. Make no mistake, there is really no difference between Hadith and Quran. Muslims will have a conniption fit and tell you there is. Not true. The Quran and the Hadith were delivered by the same individuals, Muhammad and his cohorts. They were maintained and passed on to us for generations orally by these exact same individuals. They cover the same period of time. One without the other is completely useless because the Quran now is a jumbled mess, thrown together haphazardly with absolutely no context and no chronology. The only way to make sense of the Quran, and Muslims know it, they just don't want you to know it, is to reorder the Quran as I did in Goddamn Religion, using the Hadith that depict Muhammad's words and his deeds and what the Muslims who lived next to him, who implemented Islam with him, said and did. Without these texts, Islam cannot be practiced as a religion, the Quran cannot be understood, and these texts go hand in glove. They convey exactly the same story, and they are what makes sense of the Quran. For example, as we turn to the 8th Surah, which is the Surah devoted to this episode at Badr, you would have no idea what the Quran was even talking about unless you were exposed to the Hadith, which explained precisely what occurred at Badar. So the thing that makes goddamn religion irrefutable, the thing that separates it from every other book that has ever been written on Islam, is that I take the hadith, such as these that are the four oldest, one by Ibn Ishaq, which was the first to be collected. It is the biography of Muhammad's life. The Tariq, which is the first history compiled in Islam's existence. It was compiled by Tabari. It's called the Tariq, or history. The collection that is organized topically by Bukhari, which is a favorite of Muslims, as well as the one collected by a man named Muslim. It is these texts that give Islam its basis. As a matter of fact, since the Quran routinely orders Muslims to follow Muhammad's example and his orders, the only place that Muhammad's example and his orders are presented is in these four hadith sources. They are essential to Islam. They represent Islam. Islam does not exist without them. And with them, Islam is reprehensible. It is the most disgusting death cult ever conceived by humankind. It has absolutely no right to exist and has been exceedingly destructive everywhere. It has gone without exception. So coveting what belonged to others, Muhammad gave us another glimpse into his sorry soul. Now, this particular one that precedes Badar was innocuous in that no one was killed, which is unique for Muhammad. Nonetheless, it is exceedingly telling. Muhammad ripped off a misguided and wholly inappropriate religious notion and then amalgamated it into Islam. As a matter of fact, without this ploy, the Quran would not exist. The Quran is simply stealing from a number of religious communities material that should never have been recorded in the first place, twisting it to suit Muhammad's unique and disgusting agenda, and then presenting it as if it came from Allah. An example of that would be that all of the earliest surahs that were recited do nothing but plagiarize the Hanif poetry of Arab converts to Judaism in Yemen, right down to the name they used for their god, Ar-Rahman. That's all it is. It's Muhammad literally stealing their rhythmic, rhyming poetry and applying it to his situation. As we move out of those early surahs, Muhammad eventually ran through all of the Hanif poetry that he could access and started to run out of material. He then went to Yathrib, today's Medina, where he was in contact with rabbis for the first time. And what he did once he was there is he purchased Talmud readings. And the Talmud readings that he purchased were some of the dumbest stories ever told. And Muhammad couldn't keep one version straight, so he tells the story of creation some 50 different times, all differently. He tells the story of Adam in the garden differently each time he tells it, hilariously confusing everything associated with it. The story of Abraham in Babylon breaking up the idols, taking an axe to them, and then blaming the largest idol. All of these stories, every one that he twists, comes directly from the rabbinic Talmud, which the Quran admits that Muhammad bought recitals from these rabbis, twisted them to serve his agenda. And that's all there is to the Quran. So the Quran is literally nothing more than this combination of taking religious texts of other people and twisting them to serve Muhammad's agenda. Even when he finally gets into trying to claim that the Christian Jesus, who he calls Esau, which is actually a transliteration of Esau, whom God hated, he just gets it completely fouled up part of that happens to be the fact that when he tells a story, he's pilfering the story from apocryphal sources. I mean, they are stories like the Gospel of Thomas, just utterly ridiculous trash, and he turned to it to fill out his Quran. And then he makes claims about Mary, for example, when there was no one named Mary. And even then, he claims it is Miriam, the sister of Moses, that gave birth to his mythical Muslim Jesus. Everything he touches throughout the entire Quran is that upside down and screwed up. So this is an example of Muhammad being not only covetous, but very easily confused and integrating pagan religious lore and the stories of other pagan religions, and even Christianity, some forms of Judaism, into his Quran and Hadith. Tabati, volume 7, page 26. Again, Tabati was the first to compose a history of Islam by putting together the Hadith from Muhammad and his companions in chronological order. The series that I'm citing from was published by the State University of New York Press, SUNY Press. They translated and published all volumes of Tabati, and this is volume 7, page 26. When the prophet, and I should stop you there, because Muhammad was not a prophet, he never got a single prophecy right. He didn't even come close to getting a prophecy right. So it was another title that he simply stole and applied to himself without any justification. Came to Yathrib, and he saw the Jews. Now, even here, Muhammad really screwed up because he calls them Ya'ud. Well, Ya'ud means Yahweh's beloved. So Allah cannot be God if you are referring to Jews as Ya'ud, since Yah is the name of the God who provided us with the Torah, prophets, and Psalms. He said he saw the Jews fasting on Ashura Day, and he questioned them. And they told him that it was the day upon which God drowned Pharaoh and saved Moses from the Egyptians. He said, "We have a better right to Moses than you do." He fasted and observed his fellow Muslims and ordered his fellow Muslims to fast with him. When the fast of Ramadan was prescribed, he made Ashura optional. So there are just some beauties in this. And the reason that we're going to cover this, even though this is not a crime in the sense of robbing other people of their possessions or killing them or enslaving them or torturing them, all of which Muhammad was great at and which this particular story highlights as it relates to what occurred to create the eighth surah of the Quran, which is called Stealing is Lawful and Good. It is a depiction of his deplorable character. It is proof that Islam is absolute rubbish as something that is even the slightest bit credible. First of all, Jews do not fast on Ashura Day. Ashura is based on Asherah. Asherah is the goddess who is the most called out and despised throughout the Torah, prophets, and Psalms. Ashura is the mother of God, the queen of heaven, the Madonna and child, and the mother goddess, if you will, of the Babylonian religion that metastasized all the way through every religion, including Christianity. She became the basis of the Christian Easter. She is the basis of the Christian Mary, being the blessed Mary, mother of God, queen of heaven. All of that is based upon Ashura, and Ashura is nothing but a pagan goddess. Jews do not fast on pagan goddess days. And for Muhammad to be so stupid that he did not know that is to say He was not someone who was speaking for God. If you're aware of anything that is in the Torah and prophets, and he claims, you know, his God claims that he authored the Torah and prophets. You know, he's saying here, we have better right to Moses than you do. So he's claiming that it's the same God, and yet Yahweh, who is actually the God who authored the Torah and prophets, tells us that Asherah is pure evil, that anyone who venerates Asherah is an abomination to God. As a matter of fact, the one of the most entertaining stories that exists throughout the Torah and prophets is when Eliyah gathers the prophets, of which there were 400 of Asherah and the 450 of Baal, the Lord, together, along with the political establishment of Israel, to eviscerate them all. And so when it comes to exposing and condemning the likes of Asherah, in fact, specifically Asherah, it's one of the greatest stories told anywhere in the Torah and prophets. So you have to be an absolute ignoramus not to know that Asherah was no more a god than the three goddesses that Muhammad incorporated into the Quran with Alat al-Uzza. It's Alat and Manat. Manat, that's the one. Alat al-Uzza and Manat, the three pagan rock goddesses of the Kaaba who Muhammad venerated in his Quran. Well, Asherah was a bigger fake goddess than them, but a bigger fake goddess does not make her real. So, first, Jews would know that Asherah is on a 1 to 10 scale of bad amongst the pagan goddesses of Babylon. She's nuclear. She is the hydrogen fusion bomb of no-nos. And so he says he questioned him about it. And the day, they said that it was the day that God drowned Pharaoh. Wrong. First of all, the day that the Gulf of Aqaba opened of the Red Sea to allow the Israelites to pass through was Bukurim. It is symbolic of Bukurim, where we are born as firstborn children into Yahweh's family. It's the idea of the water breaking and the natural childbirth. Well, here the children of Israel come out the other side of the Gulf of Aqaba. So following Pesach, which would open the doorway to life for the firstborn children of Israel, and Matzah, where the children of Israel were able to escape, to walk away from the religious and political corruptions of Mitzrayim, Egypt, the next of the Mikre to be fulfilled is Bukurim, and it is symbolic of Pharaoh's army being drowned in the Gulf of Aqaba as they pursued the Israelites to kill them. Double wrong, however, is that Pharaoh wasn't among them. The story is quite clear, and so is history. Pharaoh's eldest son, and this is Pharaoh Thutmose, Pharaoh's Thutmose the Great, Pharaoh's oldest son died, just as the Torah explains. But Pharaoh himself was not among those pursuing the Israelites, and he did not die. So they got that wrong, too. And saved Moses from the Egyptians. Okay, so he said, we have a better right to Moses than you do. The claim is because once Muhammad moved to Yathrib, today's Medina, and started purchasing Talmud readings from the rabbis, he essentially claimed that everyone in God's story was a Muslim. Just for good measure, in addition to Moses being a Muslim, which is absurd. It's the fact, the moment the Dead Sea Scrolls were unearthed, and by the way, by a Bedouin boy, a Muslim boy, in 1950 and then published around 2000. The moment they became available to us, Islam should have just crawled in a hole and said, okay, everything in the Quran is a lie. And this is because Allah claims to be the God of Moses and Aaron and Noah and Adam and Abraham and Sarah, and it goes on and on and on. And yet when the Dead Sea Scrolls were found, it proved that no, Yahweh was the God who spoke to all of these people and interacted with all of them, and there's absolutely no mention of an Allah. And this, of course, precedes the creation of Islam by 1,000 years. And Muhammad was of the statement, as well as Allah in the Quran, that, oh, well, the Jews changed their scriptures after they sold them to Muhammad and after Muhammad started to recite them. So Muhammad's version is the true version, and the Jews in the 7th century CE changed them. Well, first of all, it wouldn't have done any good for Jews and Yathrib to change them, because by that time there were thousands of copies all the way around the world, and the Jews of Yathrib would not have done that. But beyond that, the fact is that there are copies that are essentially identical to what we read today, found in the caves above Qumran, that prove emphatically that the Jews in Yathrib did not change them, completely negating the entire narrative of the Quran, so that it's just turned to absolute rubbish if you've got any functioning neurons in your brain. So, no, they did not have better right to Moses, but Muhammad was exceedingly covetous. Yeah, he claimed everything for himself, including all women, including all people as slaves. Those he didn't kill, he enslaved, including everyone's property. This was just the nature of Muhammad. So he fasted, and he ordered his fellow Muslims to fast with him. He ordered it, and you read here that it was when the fast of Ramadan prescribed, he made a shura optional, which means that at this point, some 14 years into Islam, there was no fast of Ramadan, but there was a fast for Ashura, which means you go to this whole notion that Ramadan is the holiest day in time in Islam now, and it wasn't even observed as a holiday for the first 14 years that Muhammad preached Islam. So if what you have here is just this whole series of absolute absurdities. When Muhammad said that he had a better right to Moses than did the Jews, his counterfeit religion became as obvious as a bloody red $3 bill with a turban portrait of an ugly and aging sand pirate on the front and cross scimitars on the back. Beneath would have been the slogan, "At war with all mankind." This statement, like so many others, is lethal to all three so-called Abrahamic religions, Asherah in Hebrew, Astarte in Babylonian Aramaic, was perceived as the great goddess, the queen of heaven, the mother of God, and the Madonna and child. She was revered by the Canaanites, the Phoenicians, the Hittites, the Assyrians, the Babylonians, and for a while, tragically, in Israel, where Jezebel from Phoenicia brought this cult down with her, and it became the dominant religion, actually, in Israel at the time that Elia was brought forth to excoriate it, and did a marvelous job of doing so. And it is Asherah that is the cohort of Baal, the Lord. The Lord is not a title for God. I know you find it all the way through your English translations of the Bible, but I'm here to tell you that Lord is Satan's title according to God. And so when you refer to your God as the Lord, as Islam does, although they use a different term rather than using Baal or Adonai, as you will find in the Hebrew, the rabbis of Yathrib pulled a fast one on Muhammad and used their own title. And so throughout the Quran, the Lord is called Rabbi. Jews were clever, if nothing else, and they were playing with a dunderhead who was illiterate, so what did he know? But anyway, Asherah was the consort of Baal, the Lord. And the reason that the Lord is the is Satan HaSatan throughout Yahweh's depictions is because he wants to lord over men. He wants to enslave men. He wants to possess men. He wants to control men. He hates humankind. And therefore, he wants people bowing down to him and worshiping him. Baal is the god of most religions. And it's one of the reasons God is so disgusted by him. So this Asherah was also associated with groves of trees, which is how she is still venerated among Jews on true B'Shabbat, the 15th of Shabbat, one of the four, yes, count them, rabbinical New Year's days, this one for trees. She is venerated by Christians with their Christmas tree, and she is also venerated by them through her poles, which became minarets by Muslims and steeples among Christians. That was the first and the last thing to catch the sun's rays early in the morning and late in the evening, is why these became associated with the goddess. She's also the basis of the progressive socialist secular humanist May Day on their Maypole. Asherah is condemned, as I have shared with you, throughout the Torah and prophets due to the prevalence of her religious cults. She was best known today as Mary, and it is this role that she is the, by far, overwhelmingly, the most mentioned woman in the Quran, and an object now of veneration, of course, in Orthodox and Roman Catholicism, which means that both of them stole this pagan legacy because it was so popular. And it became a very easy way for Roman Catholics and Orthodox Christians to control women, to give women this object of worship for them, that they could say this rosary and they could, you know, pray to and do all of this sort of thing. Well, they're, when you're venerating Mary in Christianity, you're venerating Asherah, this pagan goddess. Even the name Mary from Miriam in Hebrew is the worst possible name you can give someone. The Miriam that the Quran says was the mother of their Jesus was actually the Miriam described as the Miriam who was the sister of Moses. She was the one who was so, as the name means, Miriam means contentious, embittered, and rebellious in Hebrew. It is the most disgusting of all Hebrew names. She's the one that said, well, we too speak for God. And Yahweh had chosen Moshe to speak for him, had inspired Moshe to speak for him. And so when they claimed that they too spoke for God, they were messengers of God, if you will, Yahweh said, no, you don't. Moshe is my guy. I spoke through Moshe. When I speak through someone, it's obvious that I have inspired them, and you do not speak for me. And just to make this absolutely clear, you are now plagued with leprosy. You are now expelled from this community, and you need to shut up. I mean, he was really raw. In fact, he actually says, I'm going to be so raw here that it's as if your father was spitting in your face. God was disgusted that someone would claim to speak for him that did not speak for him. And guess who made that same claim? Not only the rabbis that sold this pile of rubbish to Muhammad, but also Muhammad. And when you do that, God makes it very clear that your fate is hell. So this is a very, very indicting, destructive statement for Muhammad to make among those who are informed and rational. And in fact, Shiite Muslims still celebrate Ashura Day. She is also the basis of Easter, yes. Ashura became Ishtar in the Akkadian variation of Ashura, and Easter in Christendom is actually named for Ishtar. In fact, her veneration time is Easter week. Oh, yes, Christianity, you ought to be embarrassed. But then again, very few people are informed. Very few people are rational. Most people just don't care anymore. And so when you bring an argument against a religion like Christianity and Islam, as we're doing, that absolutely is totally destructive to it. So there's nothing left to believe. They will attack the person bringing the information because there is no retort to it. Now, under a host of different designations, Asherah was venerated from Sumer, Babylon, and Assyria to Egypt, Greece, and Rome. She was called Kodesh, the Holy One, Baalat, the Lordess, and Rabat, the Exalted Female, which are all embarrassing to Islam due to their inclusion in the Quran. Her name was derived from the Hebrew and Aramaic Asher, which as Asherah would be female. Asher is among the most widely used Hebrew words because it is a proper name, a noun, a preposition, a relational pronoun, and a verb. And it means to advance and to make progress by leading and walking along a straight path to a blessed and happy relationship. This is why Hasatan covered it, the title, and used it. Her devotees coined the straight path concept found in the Quran. She was also known as Hawat, Eve, and Chut, the snake in Phoenician, because she was considered to be the mother of all life, and her cultic objects and idols were often shown holding serpents and revealing her toxicity and her potential for immorality. There is a considerable scholarly debate indicating that the rabbinical and later Quranic use of the Shekinah was to project the feminine attributes of the goddess's presence. And I share this with you because the Quran mentions Shekinah on a number of occasions, and Shekinah has no basis whatsoever with Yahweh. It's not found in the Torah prophets. Shekinah is a rabbinical construct, meaning that when you see it in the Quran, it is proof that it was pilfered from rabbinic lore, from their Talmud. The Shekinah, according to the rabbis, is the presence of God, but God never uses that term. And it is to, because of the ending, to project the attributes of the maternal nature and the feminine side of God, giving the rabbis the same thing that Roman Catholics wanted, the same things that the Babylonian wanted. It's easiest to control women if you give them an object of veneration. And the Shekinah was the object of veneration for Judaism, giving Jewish women someone to pray to, someone who they could be devoted to. As an Allah, she was a large tree associated with El God. Allah is a large tree in Hebrew, spelled exactly the same way as the name now of the Islamic God. As such, she was typically represented by date palms. She was called all-merciful, all-forgiving, and most beneficial. These names and titles permeate so many of the surahs in the Quran, it's as if Muhammad just gobbled this poison up like it was a precursor to Kool-Aid. His association with the Quranic Allah, especially Alat and Al-Laha, is troubling for Islam because she was called, catch this, Alat, which is also the feminine form of El and also Alat. She was a rabbi, Rabat in the feminine form, exalted one in the Ugonic text, and thousands of years before Allah adopted the this same title. In the fables of the Baal epic, Asherah's son, Yam, Day, the god of the sea, is shown struggling against Baal, the Lord God, for supremacy, not unlike Allah challenging Yahweh on the last day. She is also depicted as a prize bovine, perhaps revealing Allah's odd affinity with cows. It's actually, the Quran is filled with lurid stories of all the ways that cows are to be used, that the cow is presented as the ultimate gift of Allah. You can mate with them. You can wear them. You can climb inside of them. You can eat them. You can do whatever you want to with a cow. And the truth is something that is probably way beyond this audience, except those who have been listening to these programs since the beginning. But the primary adversary of the adversary is depicted by Yahweh as a par, bull, and in the final sacrifice that prepares Yisrael to be ready for Yahweh's return along with the dod. He is presented as a parah, which is a feminine term for cow. And so Allah's ultimate demise is at the result of a cow. So he must claim that he has total control over them. Surprise, surprise. She was known, this Asherah, was known as Asherah in Aramaic inscriptions found in Arabia, and as the consort of the moon god, Amon, as far back as the 6th century BCE, 12, 13 centuries before Islam. Therefore, among the many stupid things to come from Muhammad's lips, claiming Ashura Day was among the most polytheistic and indicting. He was as dumb as the stone he claimed was God. And this ode to religious polytheism does not stand alone. Even Ramadan honors false gods and pagan religiosity. This fast for self-purification was initially part of the crying for Tammuz legacy of the Jewish captivity in Babylon. Tammuz was the model for the Christian Jesus and the Islamic Isa, and likely introduced resurrection into the religious landscape. Catholic Lent is derived from this same rite, and Muhammad reestablished the pagan Tanunath fast of Ramadan, saying that they commemorated his wrestling match in the cave with a demonic spirit. Yes, when Muhammad was first heard the Quran recited to him, he was out on, according to the Islamic sources, a Tanunath fast during the month of Ramadan, which was pagan in its religiosity. And he went into this cave at night, and a demonic spirit, from his own admission, wrestled him to the point of death and lied to him as well. It's one of the dumbest recitals ever in the Quran. It's amazing that Islam survived its first recital, which, by the way, is not at the beginning of the book. It's in the 96th surah, and it tells an illiterate man to read. Then it tells him that man was created from a clot of coagulated blood. It even goes on to say, read what the pen wrote long before there were pens. And of course, on top of all of this, the Quran was not written until almost a century after Muhammad's encounter in the cave with this demonic spirit. And Muhammad ran out of the cave, tried to kill himself, and then confessed to us that he tried to kill himself because he had been demon-possessed. This was Islam's actual beginning. So needing to confiscate everything belonging to the Jews, including their fables, their lies, as well as everything else, to please his demonic spirit, Muhammad told his fellow terrorists that they should take a break from raiding civilians and celebrate a religious holiday, even if it was a complete and utter fiasco. But it wouldn't last. Stealing a ritual was insufficient to prop up Islam. Muhammad needed his own he needed to own everything the Jews possessed, including, as we have already heard in the two series I have done previously, their homes, their lives, their wives, their children, and their souls. Returning to Muhammad's scheme, we find, cursor just jumped so far ahead that there is absolutely no way I'm going to be able to go back to where I once was. And so all I can do at this point is to tell you, well, my computer just completely shut down. So I'm going to stop at this point with the introduction to the war surah of the eighth in the Quran, which is stealing is lawful and good. And we're going to resume with the prelude to Muhammad's vile acts at Badr in our next program. By way of introduction, what you're going to learn is that Muhammad had no interest in spreading Islam. The Quran makes this clear, as do the Hadith. Muhammad's only interest was in trying to convince his militants that a caravan that was being run by his extended family, his own kin, should be confiscated to fund his new religion and his lifestyle. And that it did not matter how many people died, how many people were enslaved, what lies were told, so long as they were too able to confiscate the booty. And that will be part of our next program. I thank you for listening. This has been episode one of the criminal enterprise that served as the basis for Islam, as we review the evidence provided in the Quran's eighth surah commemorating it. I am your host, Craig Wynn.